state-operated services reorganization. Really, it's not an update. It's a report on the plan for reorganization. And we have with us this morning Dr. Reed Sulik. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dr. Reed Sulik, Assistant Commissioner of the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Sitting with me also is Mr. Michael Tesner, CEO of the State-Operated Services Division of the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. I intend to present an overview of the report that was released last week titled Chemical and Mental Health Services, Transformation, the State-Operated Services Redesign in Support of the Resilience and Recovery of the People we Serve. I intend in this presentation to be able to walk through the purpose behind the design, so essentially the why, what, and how, and when. So in other words, why the redesign of state-operated services was necessary, speak more specifically about what exactly is being redesigned, talk about the how it will and can happen, and what will be the process and when the changes occur. There's some background information that I want to kind of go over as well in a little bit more detail than we've been able to go over before. I think that there's a bigger picture view that's really important to have. This slide, which is slide number 3 in the handout, depicts in calendar year 2008. And I just want to say that I'm showing calendar year 2008 because that was the year in which we started to see the investments from the Mental Health Initiative approved in 2007 with some newer investments of funding. Out of a total $595,529,000, state-operated services expenditures, the appropriation of state-operated services expenditures, represented approximately 30% of that $595 million. So if we step back and we think about the proportion of cost, there's of all adult mental health, public mental health dollars spent in Minnesota on adult mental health services, totaling $595.5 million, roughly 30% represents the state appropriation to state-operated services. So anything we do to try to make state-operated services more efficient and more effective ultimately does influence the effectiveness of the entire system. So this is demonstrate what I will intend to walk through is how we can how we have significant pressures, and I'll explain that, solving some budget deficits currently in the state-operated services budget, how we've had to think through managing that and recognizing the need for the state-operated services to not be anywhere near as isolated or siloed as it has historically, and to be much better integrated with the rest of the system that is representing that $595 million.
Dr. Sulik, it might not make any difference in terms of the point you're making here, but state-operated services also has Medicaid and other earnings. And I don't see that unless it's under the other.
Correct. Actually, here, this is total funding sources spent through the department. So if Medicaid is spent, it's not necessarily – there's not a piece of the pie here is saying specifically state-operated services. So what we're saying is if you look at all the different funding sources of that making up that $595 million, roughly 30% of that – is going towards the appropriation. Now, in addition to that, there is whatever is collected through Medicaid and JAMC, et cetera. So, again, the point to emphasize here is state-operated services is still an enormous piece of the entire system of mental health delivery services in the state of Minnesota.
I guess it doesn't probably matter here. I'm gathering it's part of the blue number.
It would be a big part of the blue. It'd be a big part of the, it'd be a big part of the blue and other that makes up this source of funding. Because, again, a significant portion comes from specific state appropriation through
legislative
funding.
Well, I hope when you go through the financing of the reorganization that we'll be able to separate out where we're at with the federal funding.
Yeah, I have some more slides that Madam Chair, that should be able to help us sort through that. The next slide, slide number four in the packet, essentially shows, again, in calendar year 2008, what is the portion of expenditure by type of service delivered. And the point I'm making here is of $595.5 million, $262 million was spent on our regional treatment centers and our community inpatient level of care. So the community inpatient level of care would include the community behavioral health hospitals. It would also include all of our community hospitals with inpatient psychiatric units across the state. And then added into that is the regional treatment, the Anoka Regional Treatment Center cost, in addition to the Minnesota Security Hospital cost. So roughly 44% of our total expenditures from 2008 still represents that high level of inpatient care provided. Madam Chair?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Sulik, when you say that the cost of, I know Mr. Tesner has told me that at the Brainerd Regional Treatment Center site, it costs $1 million to maintain that site. Is that included in that portion that you're talking about for keeping the boiler going and just keeping the place going? Is that included in there? Is that what you're talking about?
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, yes.
Dr. Sulik.
Yes, as you start talking about our total expenditures, and there's a big piece of a lot of our expenditures that we've got to be mindful of. Our goal is to make as high a percentage of those expenditures going to direct care services, and that would be an example of what's not allowing us to put that towards direct care.
And, Madam Chair, if I could say something else, I would just say I'd be interested to know how much money you're spending, like that situation, $1 million there, just to maintain. There's a tremendous amount of buildings that are just sitting there empty. And how much money are we just spending on that? We're just really flushing it down the toilet, really.
Madam Chair, the other point, just to help understand this slide, is that 44% I'm referring to essentially is the blue and the red combined. So if you take the blue, which represents 20% of the total expenditures, is still spent in the combination of Anoka Regional Treatment Center and Minnesota Security Hospital. And I would guess that MEDO is also part of that because it's a campus-based level of care. The rest of the care that represents an inpatient level of care is represented in the red, and that's a combination of the community behavioral health hospitals and our community hospitals with inpatient psychiatric units. Now, the next slide, I've gone and depicted this with inflation-adjusted dollars so that we can look at a trend in Minnesota. If we look at from 2000 to 2008, now this is true fiscal years. I just want to point out that the last fiscal year being represented here, fiscal year 2008, the last half of the fiscal year started to have the investments of the mental health initiative really started in the last half of the fiscal year. So what you're seeing here is that about half of the expenditures in the first part of the decade, about half the expenditures went to the inpatient, which is a combination of the regional treatment center and inpatient level of care, and about half went to outpatient care. Roughly in the year 2000, $177 million spent on both types of care. As we course through the years, you can see that there's positively a trend down in total expenditures on inpatient level of care. This is a trend that we want to see. We want to see the larger portion of our expenditures being invested and spent in services delivered at the community level and not relying so much on an inpatient level of care. The question here is, where is our benchmark? Now, I'm collecting that information from around the country right now. What are other states, what are they seeing in regards to their percentage of investments in inpatient level of care and regional treatment center level of care compared to outpatient community level of care? The outpatient community level of care includes the whole array of services, ACT services, ARM services, ERTS, and other community residential services as well. So the real question is, what is the percent of total cost of care should inpatient cost be? I found as low a percentage as 13% in the state of Rhode Island. So the state of Rhode Island, from a paper in 2001, demonstrated that of the adults with mental illness in the state of Rhode Island, 13% of the total expenditures went to inpatient care compared to the array of outpatient services. So if you look at where we were in 2001, we were right at the 50% mark.
So Dr. Sulik, does the non-inpatient expenditures include our other health care programs, Medicaid, Minnesota Care, et cetera, dollars being spent on services for people with mental illness?
Madam Chair, it includes that. This slide includes that, but it literally represents, did they receive outpatient or community-level care versus inpatient-level care. So if they were being paid, Medicaid would pay, if Medicaid dollars were spent to provide inpatient care, it's represented on this slide. So this is literally looking at total state expenditures of all public dollars spent on adult mental health services. Children's mental health services is not depicted here. But this is a trend that I just want to point out. We started to close the regional treatment centers in the early part of this decade, so you started to see a trend down in total cost. Yet, as we started to open the community behavioral health hospitals, we started to see, if we divided regional treatment center by community inpatient level of care, we still see the community inpatient level of care costs rising with each year as the regional treatment center cost is starting to really taper down. So the combination still is getting us where we're still too close to the 50% mark. Our goal would be what changes in the system lead to less reliance on inpatient level of care so that there's broader community-based levels of care available.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and Dr. Sulik, then you, when you went to the 16-bed hospital, you said that you saw it come down some, and then you saw it go up a little bit. But when we went to the 16-bed facilities, the federal government paid for half of that. So shouldn't our expenditures at the state level go down dramatically?
Well, Senator Coring, I think we need to remember that only those facilities that were certified did we get federal funding for.
And
only a couple of them were ever certified. So.
And why was that, Madam Chair?
Federal government has a hard time understanding our model that we were trying to use. I think they haven't seen it in a lot of other states where, you have facilities like that that are still owned by the state.
So the 16-bed units, Madam Chair, just because there's one in Fergus Falls or one in Brainerd, that doesn't necessarily mean that the federal government is paying for half of that then, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Correct. Madam Chair, Senator Coring, there's 4 of the 10 original community behavioral health hospitals that received CMS certification, so only 4 were able to collect the federal match component of the care. This next slide is a slide that would be important for you all to pay attention to as well. And it demonstrates the 3 sources of funding, whether state, federal, or county, by year. Again, calendar year is noted at the very end instead of fiscal year 2008, demonstrating the investments of the Adult Mental Health Initiative into the system in that in calendar year 2008. So you can see that although there was a rise in federal match dollars over this period of time, it is still not at the same level of increase of state investments that we've had in this last decade.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Sulik, on the county portion of that, I'm wondering on a per capita basis, is there a lot of variation in that number from county to county?
Madam Chair, Senator, the county portion, if we think back to a big significant piece of this is tied to the maintenance of effort, which is not necessarily tied to per capita. It is tied to previous expenditures. So that's why we see this somewhat fixed when it comes to the county investment in this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Sulik, I understand that that's the system we had in place, but if we were to look at it and then put it, graph it on a per capita basis just to compare the relative investment of local governments into this system, that's what I'm trying to get at and wondering if there's a significant difference.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, let me do that and see what that looks like. We have not plotted that against this graph yet, but I think that that's a very good question to see what kind of a trend we would see.
I would expect, if I were going to guess, that you would see the counties that use Anoka having higher per capita expenditures because that is a more costly type of facility, and with their state, with the county share, I mean, you know, the utilization of institutional services in the outstate counties has decreased, I think, faster than the institutional utilization in the metro area.
Did she say decreased?
Before I move on, let me go back to this slide just for one quick point, and that is that, you know, when we started to move into the 16-bed community behavioral health hospital model, the piece that we found was that, you know, again, when I've been before the committee, demonstrating some of the utilization data, you've heard me say that the utilization of the community behavioral health hospitals was not what was expected. You know that we've spent the last year really fully trying to come to understand that, and that's been part of some of the pressures I'm going to demonstrate for you in the next couple slides. But just some background I want you to have in mind, that the cost of the, 10 community behavioral health hospitals, roughly at a cost of 45 million dollars total. I don't have the exact figure in my head. It's there in the data. We served over 1,600 people last year with an average length of stay of about 20 days in the community behavioral health hospitals across the state. At Anoka Regional Treatment Center, we served approximately 540 individuals with an average length of stay of approximately 100 days. The cost of Anoka Regional Treatment Center was at least equal to, if not more, than the total cost of the 10 community behavioral hospitals. So we definitely moved in the right direction in moving into a different type of care just 5 years ago as we started that movement. You can't tell me that the people served at the community behavioral hospitals, a lot of people would argue that a lot of them are different than who winds up at Anoka. I think that there's some truth to that. But there's a model out here that we've been working on in Minnesota that other states have not taken on, and it's still an evolution. And a lot of what we're going to talk about for the rest of this morning is what the next phase of this evolution in this design really can be. So,
Dr. Sulik, yes. We agree with your analysis of the cost of Anoka compared to the rest of the system. That's one of the reasons why the legislature asked you to redesign Anoka. But I must say that at least from what I've been able to see so far of the redesign effort, not very much is being done with Anoka. So we'll be interested to hear more about that as you go on.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you'll hear me address that this morning. So let me introduce you to the confluence of pressures that state-operated services was under at 9-10 months ago when we were first asked to craft a report on Anoka Regional Treatment Center and MEDO redesign. We also had significant pressures with gaps and barriers to access and effectiveness within our state system. What we've been hearing consistently across the state is we're having difficulty getting access of an individual's into the system. Once in the system, there's gaps in the appropriate flow of individuals back into community levels of care. There's often, quote, bottlenecks, unquote, when individuals wind up in one level of care and can't transition appropriately to the next level of care. We also had system inefficiencies across the state system. This is a costly system, and one of the things that we've had to be very mindful of is how do we achieve as efficient a system of care as possible, knowing that our resources are needed, yet our resources are limited. By system inefficiencies, I can say that, for instance, regardless of what the census was on an inpatient unit, we were staffed at that unit for the total bed capacity of that unit. There's been a lot of need to change a lot of thinking and staffing patterns and a lot of design models that allow us to create as efficient a system as possible. We had significant budget pressures, as you all are well aware of. I will, on the next slide, I will walk us through the budget pressures that, in the details of the budget pressures that State Operated Service has been faced with in the last year. And as Madam Chair, as you have stated, we had a legislative mandate to develop a report about how Anoka could be redesigned and Meadow could be redesigned. In order to understand how Anoka could be redesigned, you have to really understand this model that the state has taken on in this last decade to transition out of other regional treatment centers into these community behavioral health hospitals. We have to learn from what worked in those models and what didn't work in those models and really fully understand that to get to an idea of what we will be able to do with Anoka differently than today. The other pressure that is not indicated on this slide that we all need to understand is at the same time that State Operated Service has its significant budget pressures, we had all of the uncertainty about what would happen to GAMC and the population being served by GAMC. In the last year, you all have heard repeatedly about the number of individuals on GAMC who have significant mental health issues, who often have required hospitalization. We needed to make certain that our capacity to serve those individuals would be there if there were significant changes to GAMC that would lead to a rise in potential commitments or a rise in other pressures requiring increased utilization of state-operated services programs. And so all of this has been going on at a very large level and a very aggressive level in the last year as we've thought through how we can solve all of these issues in a timely manner. What makes up the $17 million state-operated services budget deficit? I'm going to walk through this slide starting with the $700,000 mark at the 12 o'clock level on the pie chart. So the $700,000 figure is a figure that was assigned to State Operated Services to try to achieve in this biennium within a redesign of State Operated Services. Greater savings attached to the next biennium through a redesign concept. However, there are $700,000 of savings expected to be achieved through the beginning of a redesign in this biennium. There was a $1.4 million general administrative reduction assigned to State Operated Services. The next item is a $1.546 million reduction in the State Operated Services operating budget. And then the $5,010,000 figure is the figure attached to State Operated Services as a result of unallotment. That totals approximately, if we add it up, $8.3 million. Those are actual cuts in the budget. And how that $8.3 million divides out is depicted on that right half of this slide. There's additional unfunded budgetary pressures that make up the remainder of that $17 million. Continuing on in this slide, the bottom slide, $2.6 million, is the result of improved, as a result of the salary adjustments, where we had unfunded salary adjustments approved for fiscal year 2009 and 2011. So, in other words,
Dr. Sulik, who approved those?
Madam Chair, that was through contracts between Minnesota Management and Budget and the Governor's Administration and the labor partners. Yeah,
right, but the point is it was approved by the administration, wasn't it?
It was, Madam Chair, I believe what I would say is this was done at a level that was beyond our control.
I'm not saying
we're responsible for
it. I'm not saying that you approved it. I'm saying some level of the administration approved these negotiations that added these costs to your program. And usually when that's done, then there's a request to increase the budget to take into account that unbudgeted pressure.
Madam Chair, correct. That was not done in this past year because of all the other extraordinary budget pressures in the system. So there was a request for us to solve this approval for the adjustment internally. But let me just explain that there's two figures there.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Dr. Sulik, I don't mean to put you on the hot seat because obviously this doesn't sound like anything that you had any control over. But I think this needs to be discussed and emphasized because it sounds like what's being said is that there were some salary increases approved for people within the state's administration that then resulted in less money being available to deliver services since you had no additional funds to pay for those additional salary increases. And so with a budget that's already being squeezed and cut in terms of the delivery of services, it's hard for me to understand how we could be giving salary increases that would further reduce the money available to deliver those services.
I think you're correct, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think, and I appreciate those observations and comments. I really want us to understand the entire big picture of what's behind all of these budgetary pressures so it's really clear to all of us. And I think we can have as meaningful a discussion throughout the rest of the morning as possible if you get this big picture. So if you see that there's $2.6 million of costs as a result of fiscal year 2009, and there's a step cost in this biennium from the fiscal year 2011 of $1.356 million. In addition to those salary adjustments that are unfunded but approved that we have to account for, there was our dental program is operating at a loss of $2.223 million each biennium. And then there is also a loss of critical access dental totaling $420,000 to this biennium. That gets us total there to about $15 and some million if you do the math. The remainder of that $17.2 million is a result of what was proposed in the governor's supplemental budget proposal, where there would be an additional $2.2 million of reductions to the state operated services operating budget. And that would be an additional reduction in the appropriation that would reduce the appropriation from an $8.3 million reduction to a total of over $10 million reduction, approximately $10.5 million reduction total. That's the pressures, financial pressures, that are currently there. This, if you notice, this page doesn't even detail what's already written into the budget that we have to manage, which includes operating a Brainerd Regional Treatment Center campus and the cost of approximately $1 million a year to maintain that campus. That's already built into this budget because it's one of the things that we're held accountable to manage.
So, Dr. Sulik, I guess I'm kind of amazed how large these numbers are, and really the only thing that we were aware of that we did last session was ask you to reorganize ANOCA, and that's the $700,000 number. I mean, it seems like most of this is being done by the administration in terms of the impacts on your budget.
Madam Chair, it's the reason that all of this is being presented all together is that none of this exists in a vacuum. So ANOCA Regional Treatment Center does not exist in a vacuum within our budget. So we therefore, it is
well, no,
really
it doesn't, but you just yourself admitted that it is the largest part of the RTC appropriation.
Madam Chair, it's not the largest part of the state operated services appropriation. It's a significant component with a large cost, and there's potentially room to achieve some efficiencies. So what we need to hear now is, as we really think through the rest of this presentation this morning, is really, can we get to a different place that allows us to have this system be much more efficient and effective as a whole, given the fact that we also have these extraordinary budget pressures that we've had to figure through and solve in this process.
Mayor Berglund.
Senator Sharon?
Just to make certain I understand, would you go back a slide? Would you help me understand what the dental loss and loss of critical access dental means in this context, what you're talking about there?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, we have five dental clinics that State Operated Services operates. We don't have a state. We don't have an appropriation for those dental clinics. We've been trying to think through in the last year and a half now how to get appropriate levels of funding that could allow us to maintain those services, given the fact that there's no state appropriation. They're operating at a significant loss. What you heard me present last year about the dental clinics was that these clinics are serving individuals that are very difficult for the community clinics to serve. We don't believe they're necessarily in competition with community clinics. However, what we have to do is recognize that there needs to be perhaps a different way of providing services to these individuals in partnership with community clinics that serves, that allows that service to be available, but at a significant cost of us owning and operating a dental clinic. The cost of us owning and operating a dental clinic leads to, right now, this roughly $2.6 million of loss to the state.
Dr. Sulik, do you think the individuals served by state-operated services are any different than the individuals served by Hennepin County Dental, Hennepin County Medical Center Dental?
Madam Chair, I'm not. I don't know enough details about the Hennepin County program to know if I can compare the two.
Well, they require anesthesia.
Again, the individuals served by our clinics are not requiring anesthesia, but they are individuals that have not been able to get access to services in their communities for a variety of different reasons. We think that with some better partnership that they could be, but we need to figure through that with our community partners across the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and Dr. Sulik, I don't understand why there's not an appropriation for this. I think I recall last when we were putting the budget together, there was some money that was unspent, and I tried to take that money and put it into this program, and I thought that happened, but I must be recalling that incorrectly.
We did provide something in this area last session, and we also set it up so that the service could get Medicaid match it hadn't been getting previously.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, keep in mind that it did not solve the full cost. And this is the situation we're left in as a result. Even after making some adjustments to the payments from last year that happened in session, we did not get to the full cost to cover the cost of this program.
I think I just have one other question, and that is, where does the $12 million deficiency that that state-operated services had last year that was covered by, on a one-time basis, by the central office fit into this $17
million? Yeah. Madam Chair, it wasn't $12 million. It was approximately
$3
million. It was still a result of the sale of the Agua Ching facility and the maintenance of that campus. Finally, that program was resolved and sold and taken care of. That was the last remaining deficit from the maintenance of that campus and facility.
So none of that $3 million fits into this $17 million anywhere?
Madam Chair, correct.
Okay, can I ask another question?
One more, Senator Coring, and then All right. We have planned pretty much time for this, but yep. I am getting a little worried that yep. we need to move on.
Just one other question. I know that in the governor's proposed budget or bonding bill, there was $5 million for demolition of buildings up at the Brainerd site. My question is that didn't pass, but if that money would stay in there, or when you do that, does the service on that debt come out of your budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, yes.
It does.
Okay, I appreciate the questions about this because this is.
Senator Erickson Ropes has a little question.
Sure.
She hasn't asked any yet. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, could we get a breakdown of those COLA adjustments?
Sure. Madam Chair, we'll get you those, Senator Coring. Here's a point I want to make about this slide. What are the options for trying to solve such a significant deficit like that? And let me start by saying not having the $17 million deficit was not one of our options. So although it'd be easy to do this in, very differently, we had to say that we had all of these pressures, this confluence of pressures that we must address. It wasn't just budget. It was also our system and trying to make our system as accessible and efficient as possible for the people we serve at the same time. So approaches to solving $17 million in our deficit, we could downsize and reduce our total expenditure. So in other words, we could do less with less, or we could prioritize and improve efficiency, so we could do more for the same amount, or we could maximize revenue options and do the same and collect more. However, regardless of what State Operated Services collects, it doesn't credit the $17 million deficit. If you remember, whatever State Operated Services collects from revenue goes directly into the general fund. Or finally, we could redesign in order to improve access by improving effectiveness as well as efficiency, and ultimately improve revenues and improve the total cost of the system. And that's what we set out to do.
And so I just have a comment to make about this slide, and that is that I don't believe that it is a very good budgeting mechanism to have revenues earned by a program go into the general fund and have no accountability within this division. And I just need to say that up front. You know, if it is possible to offset appropriations made from the general fund by using federal funds that you earn, we should do that, because then you're accountable for that revenue. When it just goes into the general fund, it's like going into no man's land. Nobody knows how much there is. Nobody knows exactly how it got there. And nobody knows if somebody changes something that gets it more or less, you know, how that's going to work. And I really believe that. And so at some point, we'd like to know how much revenue State Operated Services is earning for the general fund.
We've got that. Do you have it off the top of your head?
I don't.
Yeah,
but we have that.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, are the extended stay beds at community hospitals part of your budget also?
Madam Chair, Senator, they are part of my administration's budget. They are not part of this direct State Operated Services budget. However, we are trying to align our budgets and our program and services so that we can get the community contract beds aligned with this system in the right way. And that's part of this redesign as well.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Sharon.
A question that I want you to know is running through my mind that I'm hearing as people talk to me about the redesign that work in various places through the system and in the private sector that depend on this system, is that when what they see in terms of the focus groups and the feedback that they're getting about this is that the what's called the redesign is one that may create effectiveness as well as efficiency within the state's budget, but is not in part is doing that by creating increased costs and pressures in others' budgets. So I think that when we're talking about this, that I would also like to have a more comprehensive understanding of how we might be solving a problem from a finance perspective, but not really solving a problem in terms of service and access for people in mental health needs.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I appreciate that comment, and I think that this is a huge plan and an enormous undertaking, and I expect there to be a lot of questions and uncertainty with the rollout of this plan as people fully come to understand it and understand the impact that this can have and how we can achieve savings, yet at the same time attempt as best as possible not to overburden the rest of the system, which is what we've set out to try to accomplish here. So what I will say is that there is a strong commitment that has kept us to the fact of not just getting out of certain areas of business to overburden the community sector, and you will hear that in the rest of this description. But I, again, keep in mind that the report that went out is a high-level report, not with an enormous level of detail. This presentation will start getting us into a next level of detail. There's still a lot to be worked out in cooperation with our community partners. But we will stay true to the underlying mission, and we will stay true to what we've committed to, which I'll walk you through those commitments that are at the root of this. As you know, we intended to try to engage a tremendous effort of stakeholder input across the state. This is a slide you've seen before when we were here last fall and said this is how we're going to go about trying to engage individuals from across the state to hear about our state system, to hear about what could be different, to hear about what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing, and what we could be doing differently to be partnering in a much more effective way. About 1,000 individuals from across the state have participated at various stakeholder meetings, whether they were here in St. Paul or regionally held across the state. And there are some very specific common threads that seem to course through all of these various meetings. And let me just run through the common threads, just a quick summary so you understand. Now, again, in the report, the last, I would say, 180-some pages of the report detail the summaries from all these different meetings. You can tell that we heard lots and lots of different things. We heard all kinds of things that we should be doing, all kinds of things that we shouldn't be doing, but there were clearly themes and patterns that we had to really listen to, watch for, and respond to. The next two slides essentially serve to just summarize some of the most common themes that continuously came up. One was to improve timely access to state-operated services. We heard that everywhere we went, indicating that people rely on us. They need us to be there. They need us to be much more engaged and integrated with them, not so siloed, and they need access in and out of the system to be as efficient and effective as possible. We were told that we were really asked to try to think about developing multiple levels of care as opposed to just one type of cookie-cutter approach to fit all. That is one thing that was very aligned with what you've heard us say appeared from our own assessment internally that we likely needed to do, looking at the individuals that we currently serve in the system at Anoka and in the community behavioral health hospitals. We were asked loud and clear to maintain our role as the safety net provider. Now, that's an interesting term in Minnesota. It doesn't necessarily exist in other states, per se. But in Minnesota, it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I do believe it's our role to try to help clarify what is meant by the safety net and to assure that we are living up to our mission to provide safety net services in the state. Essentially, what we heard loud and clear is by being a safety net provider, our role should really truly be to support and enhance the entire system, not to compete with other providers, but again, to partner, support, and enhance, and to provide services when others are not able to provide those services. That's a broad-based definition, but we always have to come back to the fact that there is an expectation that the state is a safety net provider for mental health services for adults. We are asked to provide services or to improve the services available across the state for individuals with specific needs, such as geriatric patients with complex medical problems, other individuals with complex medical conditions, and individuals with psychiatric illnesses and very complex behavioral needs. We also heard loud and clear across the state that outreach and services to persons in jails was highly needed. We heard loud and clear that transportation continues to be a significant issue. You all have heard me talk about this before in this committee. It's one of the things that I do think absolutely must change in our state. If we're truly going to be different, we need to not be transporting people in a way that puts them back 150 years in philosophy and approach. We still are relying on law enforcement to transport an individual requiring hospitalization. I find that absolutely unacceptable, and it is time for us to really figure through how a different transportation system serving individuals requiring hospitalization and other access to services for psychiatric needs can occur differently in this state. We were asked to improve the sharing of data and accessibility of medical records in and out of our system with other providers. And as I said earlier, we heard loud and clear, do not compete or duplicate existing services, but rather enhance and partner with community providers. We heard about the need for developing housing options across the state for individuals with mental illness. We heard the need to develop more flexible funding solutions, and we heard the need to improve system-wide recruitment for mental health professionals. Everybody is struggling to find mental health professionals to serve their region and the state, particularly as soon as you get outside the greater the metropolitan area. Anywhere in greater Minnesota is struggling in recruitment, particularly of psychiatric care providers, but a whole array of mental health providers as well.
Dr. Sulik, did you hear people tell you that we needed less access for dental care for our disabled and mentally ill population?
Madam Chair, what we did hear, what I will say is we heard, if the state is going to be providing dental services, why aren't we providing dental services for individuals with mental illness, when primarily those dental services are serving individuals with developmental disabilities? We heard that loud and clear. There's some incongruency in this hodgepodge of services that has been made up as state-operated services over the years. And arriving at some clear direction in what our true mission is and what we can and cannot do, given our limited resources, we got to get there. If the state says our role should be to provide dental services, then we need to figure out how to provide dental services. But last year, when I was here at the committee, I didn't necessarily hear that loud and clear from this committee either. There's questions. Should the state be doing that, or should the state not be doing that? If you all really want to explore that, then we need to explore that together and figure out how to fund dental services so that they could be provided through the state. But know that there may very well be other options in partnership with other community providers if we can figure through how to get there. I don't have the answer to do that today.
Well, Dr. Sulik, with the unallotment of critical access dental services in the Medicaid program, I think every community is seeing fewer and fewer dental providers, even safety net providers, willing to take clients that are paid for through our public programs. And so where these partners are that you think you're going to find, I find it difficult to see where they are. I know they aren't in my community.
Madam Chair, I think that there's a new model now with the federally qualified health centers now being able to provide dental services and receive cost level reimbursement, and I will tell you that we have got to aggressively explore that in the state. That's one of the things that our consultants that were in this process really said to us loud and clear. We are not doing a good enough job in this state at maximizing our abilities for our federally qualified health centers to be able to provide dental services. So that could be a solution.
Well, even our federally qualified health centers in my district are turning away dental patients that they previously had been serving. Senator Sharon?
In your meetings, have you heard what I've heard, which is that in terms of this not competing and but enhancing, that under the current system, at least, there is a backup in the community psychiatric units whose function, because of the limitations placed on them for reimbursement, is stabilization for and where there's medical complications along with psychiatric complications, but that the community behavioral health hospitals are defining themselves in the same way, so they refuse to transfer patients, forcing these hospitals to hold on to patients way too long. They're not reimbursed for it. It's uncompensated care. When, in fact, my understanding was that it was really those community behavioral health centers that were to take those patients to relieve that pressure for the open those beds up for the next set of patients that need that kind of high-level stabilization and then movement through out back into the other smaller system. So I'm just wondering if you've heard about that. I hope you have, because I think it is a terrible problem on our hospitals that have sustained psychiatric beds and are likely to not do that in the future based on what's happening here with this, what I'm describing, as well as the reimbursement rates.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, I'm very much aware of this, of these issues with the flow between these various levels of care. One of the things that you will hear me talk about later this morning about our proposal here is to create partnerships that require a community hospital and a community mental health center and other community providers to be at the table with the state to serve those, to serve the people of their region in a different way. And what we're hoping for is that by developing a state-private partnership in a totally different way, it brings the people to the table in a much different way. I don't want to use the word forcing integration, but it really gets us there much in a much cleaner way if the partnership requires all of those players to be at the table and working together in an integrated way.
So let's continue through the presentation so we can actually see how this is supposed to happen, and then we'll ask questions about how and whether it's happening.
Thank you. Slide 14, let me just walk you through when, after all of the state meetings we came through and before we came up with a plan that tried to put all the puzzle pieces together, we made the following 11 commitments. The first is that we will assure active engagement of consumers and families in the planning and implementation decisions of this transformation. Know that there is a huge commitment from this day forward to have consumers and families involved in the development of these various levels of care that you will hear me talk about, and to engage them at a totally different level in the design of their own care when accessing services. The second is that we will significantly improve access to chemical and mental health care. The third is that we will create multiple levels of care within same facilities whenever possible so that individuals in need may receive the right care at the right time in the right location. The fourth is that we will optimize and leverage all appropriate and available funds to serve our clients. The fifth is that we will partner with community mental health systems, with community hospitals, with community larger health systems, with community primary care clinics and health plans, in order to create an integrated partner network of care. And the sixth is that we will fulfill our leadership responsibility in the state and work to establish the quality standards of excellence in care for all providers in the state so that all consumers, no matter who they are or where they live, can be assured to receive the highest quality of care possible. Number seven is that we will continue to provide the Minnesota safety net for chemical and mental health care by assuring that capacity is built through new partnerships and new incentives. And number eight, that we pledge that all decisions in the transformation plan will attempt to value and retain employees to the best of our ability. We recognize that the employees of the Chemical and Mental Health Administration, especially those within state-operated services, are experienced, are skilled, and I will tell you from my experience in meeting many of them, are compassionate and dedicated individuals who provide care for those individuals truly with the most complex needs in the state. There's no way that we can do this without impacting many of them, and I want to be honest about our task at hand, knowing that people will be impacted by these changes. We pledge that the primary outcome of our transformation will dramatically impact the current reliance on inpatient psychiatric hospital beds and shift resources to further develop the community infrastructure as envisioned by the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group and the Governor's Task Force on Mental Health. Bringing reference to that, because that slide I showed you of trends, we've created momentum in the state in this last decade, and all of us are responsible to making sure that we can come out of these economic changes in a way that does not derail the momentum that has been created. And finally, we pledge as public stewards serving the people of Minnesota to be fiscally responsible while using the aforementioned commitments. We must address the $17 million deficit. Know that then my staff all were asked to make certain that any changes are fully aligned with the seven goals of achieving excellence that you've heard me present previously, that the entire administration is committed to. And finally, three themes arose that we can create a redesign, essentially a transformation redesign of state-operated services that is commitment to the movements of resilience and recovery, that is committed to a dramatically different level of access to care, and is committed to partnership like never before. I won't spend a whole lot of time on details about the background of these, but I will say that essentially, the resilience. If you use the word recovery in adults, you really need to think about resiliency and the resilience in youth. Our programs need to be designed, and care needs to be provided in a way that is helping each individual on their journey to recovery, with the expectation that all individuals can achieve recovery. Our ultimate goal in care is wellness, and all that needs to be fully ingrained in this program, in all of our programs, and there's a newfound commitment to that. The recovery movement does involve a tremendous amount of clear service standards across the country, including illness management and recovery, integrated dual diagnosis treatment, peer support services, person-centered care, and trauma-informed care. These are programs and services that clearly will need to course through all of state-operated services at a high level of standard in a new redesign. We've committed to improving access service and essentially developing a psychiatric access service that will involve consultation, comprehensive assessment, triage and referrals to appropriate care, not just referral to admission. It will include care coordination and will also include the development of a psychiatric access transportation system. Note that this service will incorporate the mental health urgent care and consultative service, which is called for in the GAMC bills to date. This would be designed as a 24-hour service. This is truly thought of as being an access to care service. And I just want to highlight again, you know, one of the difficulties that we heard regarding access to care was our process of approving or not approving admissions. This is not just about admissions. What we found is most people calling central pre-admissions needed a great deal of consultation on helping an individual get access to care and services. And so this is a much broader 24-hour service that we'll be committed to creating in this state. We intend to create partnerships at a different level by creating state-private partnerships with community hospitals, community mental health centers, and other providers, including primary care providers and payers. We hope to be able to regionally provide level one psychiatric care centers, level two psychiatric care centers, and also psychiatric extensive recovery treatment services, in addition to the wide array of community services currently available. I'll walk you through what these levels of care are currently proposed to be. A level one psychiatric care center would be modeled after a level one trauma center. Essentially, these would be regional centers developed to partner with community hospitals to provide 24 hours of staffed in-house psychiatric coverage, providing highest intensity of care so that those with the highest acuity and the highest complexity can be appropriately treated regardless of the time of the day, regardless of the day of the week. It would essentially model the same level of intensity that we're able to provide through level one trauma centers. Clearly, not every hospital in the state of Minnesota has needed to be a level one trauma center. Clearly, every hospital doesn't need to be a level one psychiatric care center. But having a regional orientation to the development of these across the state certainly makes a lot of sense. Where these will be, we don't have that worked out yet. That clearly needs to be developed in dialogue and discussion with our community partners within the regions across the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Thank you. Dr. Sulik, do you envision that they will be state-operated facilities or community hospitals?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Sullen, let me finish, because we'll get there. Because what I envision, that these will be clearly a partnership. Like, this is a newly designed partnership model that I want to get to so that we have an opportunity to dialogue that. The level two psychiatric care center is essentially the same level of care that is provided in most of our inpatient psychiatric care centers, our inpatient hospitals providing an inpatient psychiatric unit across the state. However, even in our inpatient hospitals, there are some hospitals who will clearly say, you know, we're not designed to take those with individuals with the highest degree of complexity and intensity. They don't have a 24-hour psychiatrist in-house. They have a psychiatrist Monday through Friday and on weekends, but on call. You know, it is the classic coverage for inpatient care. When we had consultants from outside of Minnesota, one of the things that they really pointed out to us is most of our programs in the state, if not all of them, are more at this level two type of level, and we're not providing the level one. We do have models of level one psychiatric care in the state, but with Hennepin County Medical Center, Regents Hospital, and Fairview University all being training facilities, they all have psychiatric residents in-house overnight. And that is essentially a model that parallels this concept. The idea is that we want to be able to create with a level one the ability to provide the highest intensity of care so that the amount of time at that level of intensity is minimized to the greatest extent. So the person is only at that highest intensity of care as long as they need to. Think of it as a surgical intensive care unit. That is the level of care that clearly we heard needs to occur in the state in a more reasonable way.
Why don't you keep going, and okay. We'll get to a place where we'll take some questions.
Okay.
But I think
the next,
we need to keep doing the overview first.
Got it. The next level of care is this step-down service that we certainly have run into the need for within our state system. As we went across the state, we've heard mixed reviews. Is this necessary or not necessary, given the current services that are available? Truly, the assessment is that this is a level of care that is not currently in existence in the state today. This would be a transitional step-down psychiatric care program, allowing an individual to transition out of a level one or a level two inpatient program faster, but providing ongoing psychiatric care and medical interventions and monitoring, even daily if needed, before transitioning to outpatient community residential care or outpatient community outpatient care. Now, let me walk through, again, those are the three sort of levels of care proposed. I will come back and talk about the partnership concept as we start thinking about how we could get to this. What I want to walk through now, though, is in the report, you heard us say that there's definitely phases to the implementation of a redesign plan. Phase one, step one, includes those things that ultimately need to happen to get us to targeting, to accomplishing savings that we must accomplish because of the $17 million deficit. They had to be thought through aggressively. They had to go through, you know, all the staff involved and all the stakeholders involved in this had to be thinking about, you know, our commitments and our goals of excellence and trying to maintain access to care. And so you did hear about the closure of some programs. And the closure of those programs have been presented thus far because it is felt that the individuals served in those programs could be served currently in the system in a different way. So let me walk through what phase one, step one entails, which essentially is closing the Community Behavioral Health Hospital in Cold Spring. That facility was taken offline in October because the census was low enough where the individuals were not, the demand for the utilization of that particular program was not significantly high. The individuals served at Cold Spring could be easily served at Annandale, at Wilmer, or in Alexandria, all within a very short distance to the Cold Spring facility. Rather than reopening that facility at this PERT level of care, which had been initially proposed would be explored when Cold Spring was taken offline, it was felt that Cold Spring would just remain permanently closed. The next would be that we would close the crisis center in Mankato. Now, the Mankato Crisis Center is a popular service, and I'll prepare you all for that. And I'm sure, Senator Sharon, you're well aware that it's a popular service in Mankato. It has served individuals through a crisis program. It provides some drop-in care. It provides some overnight care. It does provide some psychiatric urgent care service, all which make great sense. We have the St. Peter Community Behavioral Health Hospital 9 miles up the road. There's got to be a way that we can serve those individuals with crisis beds available in the St. Peter Hospital because we don't have all 16 beds filled at the St. Peter unit. There's got to be a way to do this. It's not perfect, but it gets us to some savings that we had to find someplace.
And can you tell us as you go through each step what the savings are?
I'm gonna wait till a slide immediately after this that outlines it. The next step is to close the community transition services in Evola. This is a residential facility, 16 beds, serving individuals mostly from the metro area. It has an average census of about 10, maybe up to 11 or 12 at times, but average census of about 10. It's felt that individuals served from the northern region in the state in the Eveleth area could be best served if there was a transitional foster care program developed for them in that area. So the closing of Eveleth also does entail the development of a transitional foster care level of care in the region as well. The following is transitioning dental services in collaboration and partnership with community dental providers. Some clinics will be closed. Some of the five will be closed, serving individuals in the remaining clinics during a period of time in which a new model of providing this dental care can be figured through.
Okay, now I think we'd like to take some questions about the slides you've done so far.
All right.
I think Senator Tomassoni has joined us. Welcome,
Thank
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my first Health and Human Services
right.
Committee meeting ever.
You might grow to like it.
I might. I'm not liking the information, though. But Dr. Sulik, I'm pleased to be here today, but I'm not very happy with the information that I'm hearing. And I noticed that your regional meetings, there were no regional meetings on the Iron Range. And two of the things that are happening is that I'm hearing that the dental college in Hibbing is going to be denied critical access funding. And it'll be zeroed out, which could cause very serious problems in that particular place. And the Eveleth closure has some ramifications for the whole campus that's there that I'm not sure people have looked at. Not only are 18 jobs being lost in a small community, but the fact is that there's a nursing home, a dialysis unit, and a clinic that are all dependent on the monies that are used for lease payments, and the money is from 76% of the lease revenue that's paid to the from the mental health services is paid to the nursing home for maintenance reimbursement. So when you close one, you have the possibility of closing all three. And I'm very concerned that maybe you have to rethink that particular one because Eveleth can't do without three of these units here, and the whole camp is closing down. So I'm very concerned about that. And, you know, Madam Chair, just a little editorial comment. Maybe the solution here is maybe we should be raising some revenue so that we don't have to close places and we don't have to deny service and we can actually keep people in the system as opposed to trying to get people out of the system. And I understand under this administration that might not be an option, but it certainly seems to be a better solution than cutting $17 million out of the system.
Dr. Sulik, kind of along the same lines, would the foster care program that would be developed, would it be developed to occupy the same space or would it be at a different location?
Madam Chair, I don't exactly have the answer to that yet. That needs to get explored. My sense is we don't need in the foster care setting the expense of the large 16-bed facility. So therefore, I'm assuming, based on everything I've heard thus far in the planning, that it would be a different location. There are potentially 18 positions that would be created through the creation of intensive therapeutic foster homes in the Eveleth region. So, I mean, you all aren't letting me go through this in the order in which I put them, so I'm going to bounce back and forth to answer some of these questions. But this slide shows potentially new jobs that would be created. And regardless of what I say in regards to the full time equivalents that are impacted by these changes, know that there's potentially some new jobs being created in this redesign, and there's currently 103 job openings in state-operated services. How do you get savings from a full-time equivalent that shifts into a job opening? It's a removal of a full-time equivalent from the total budget. But we've got 103 openings in the system that currently people are providing coverage for through overtime and other expenses. So anything that we do to minimize the number of openings in the position helps, in the system helps. I'm going to show you this slide. I'll jump down to this slide now, and then we'll go back and talk about phase one, step two. But phase one, step one, you see that closing the Community Behavioral Health Hospital in Cold Spring, this is slide 32 if you're looking for it, essentially has projected savings of approximately $3 million. There's 26 full-time equivalents impacted by that closure. Closing the Mankato Crisis Center has projected savings of $1.3 million and has potential full-time equivalents of 14. However, some of those positions would be transferred into the St. Peter facility. I don't know, honestly, if that 14 number already takes that into account or not. Closing Eveleth leads to $1.4 million in savings and impacts for 18 full-time equivalents. And transitioning dental in this current plan would lead to $1.4 million in savings, impacting 23 full-time equivalents. So that phase one, step one, leads to 80 time full-time equivalent positions lost in the system and a savings of $7.1 million towards the $17 million.
And is there a timetable for step one?
There is. Step one would occur essentially, I'll find my slide about the timetable. Here we go. Within the next 3 months. Phase one, step two, occurs over the next 15 months.
May I just reiterate one more time, Dr. Sulik, the importance of how one facility affects another facility in Eveleth, and that closing one will not only have the impact of just closing the mental health facility, but it'll close the clinic and the dialysis unit because of the way the revenues interact. And so I think you have to take another good hard look at this before you do it.
Madam.
Dr. Sulik.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to hear more. I heard you, and it's understood, and I'd be happy to hear more. Now, let's, other questions before
Madam
I
Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, yes, before we go on to step two, I have a couple of questions on step one. I'll go facility by facility. In Cold Spring, can you just clarify again that this facility closed in October? So would it be a true statement that the 26 FTEs that you're calculating in savings, that facility's already closed, and those 26 people are currently out of work?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, those, the employees from that facility were transferred to Annandale or some to Wilmer Community Behavioral Health Hospitals during a period of time in which it wasn't certain if that facility would reopen at this PERT level of care or different level of care. So there were no layoffs at the time that the facility was taken offline. It was taken offline because there were a number of job openings in the facility, and rather than aggressively recruiting to refill those, the staff in that facility were reassigned elsewhere. So those individuals, if they're not currently in positions that would be required for the other facilities, that full-time equivalent position may be impacted.
Dr. Sulik, what does the line transitional dental mean?
The line means to transition the dental services to a community clinic level of care. And we don't, again, as I said, our idea would be that to try to find clinics that these individuals could be served through the FQHC model of care in a different way. But right now, we don't have that worked out.
Well, if it's supposed to happen in the next 3 months, I'm getting nervous. How many full-time equivalents do you have providing dental care?
Madam Chair, the proposal right now is that some of those clinics would close, but not all of them.
That's what I'm trying to figure out here. Right. Transitional dental with 23 full-time equivalent impacts doesn't tell me whether all of your dental program is gone, or some of it's gone, or which part of it is gone.
And this has already been announced to staff?
Yes.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, of the five clinics, Fergus Falls, Wilmer, and Cambridge would close, and Brainerd and, where's the second?
Faribault.
And Faribault would remain open. So we would have one clinic in Brainerd and one clinic in Faribault that would remain open to serve individuals that currently can't be served elsewhere. But the clinic in Fergus Falls, Wilmer, and Cambridge would be closed. That's part of step one. The remaining two clinics would remain open with the idea that they would transition over the course of the following 15 months into a different model.
So even though it's not in step two, there would be another transitional dental component?
Madam Chair, correct. That the idea is that although we are not budgeting closure of those two clinics in step two, the idea is that by the end of the 15-month period, we've got a plan established for dental services for those individuals. So those two clinics are remaining open in the remaining of this biennium.
Okay. Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, I still have questions about Eveleth.
Yes.
Do you envision that the therapeutic foster home would be an 18-bed facility, or would it be 18 facilities?
Madam Chair, Senator, the foster home would be a 4-to-5-bed model. There are currently, of the individuals served at the Eveleth facility, approximately 4 on average are from the Iron Range area. So there would be at least one, not two, but one, correct, that's proposed? There would be one transitional foster home with 4 to 5 beds developed in the Eveleth region.
So, Madam Chair and Dr. Sulik, that's a different level of care, though. So where would these patients go? Would they go to Brainerd, then? If they needed the state-operated facility?
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, Eveleth has not been a well-defined level of care. I actually talked a little bit about that in one of our committee hearings last year, that's a program that's not defined as an ERT. It's not defined as a group home. It's existing without clear clarification of its level of care, which has left it unable to maximize any type of funding sources besides the state appropriation for it. So the idea is, by transitioning into a foster level of care, individuals may be eligible for some component of waivered services. There may be eligibility to maximize non-state funding to provide care for those individuals as well.
Madam Chair, Dr. Sulik, that's a surprise to me, since I referred patients to that facility when I thought they needed the highest level of care. And I can't imagine those patients at that time being able to function in a foster home.
Dr. Sulik?
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, the idea here would be, if we can have level 1, level 2, and PERTS levels of care developed across the state, in addition to these transitional foster homes levels of care, that should constitute a level of care that doesn't currently, an array of services that may not currently exist. There's a number of individuals currently served at Eveleth that may be much more appropriate to be served at an ERT, or maybe needing a PERT level of care with that psychiatric monitoring and care, but it's not currently there.
Sure. So, Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Dr. Sulik, then my original question is, where will those that need the highest level of care be served in northeastern Minnesota?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Mike Tessner with the Department of Human Services. Senator Prentner-Solon, we are anticipating the level of care in this intensive foster placement will be similar to what is provided at Eveleth. It will have access to an array of professional staff that a typical foster placement wouldn't have. We actually operate one of these sites currently out of the Brainerd-Baxter area, Pillager, actually, serving individuals with complex service needs. And the staffing it's an intense level of staffing, higher numbers of direct care staff, but the professional services are provided either through the Brainerd-Baxter CBHH or actually the MEDO program. So it's not a typical foster placement. It's a much more enhanced, intensive set of services that would be available. And as I said, we're anticipating serving essentially that same level of care currently provided at Eveleth. So the idea is that service in the Eveleth area that's serving folks from that region continues.
Senator Sharon.
I'm talking about step one, the crisis center in Mankato. I know that you referred to it as a popular center, which sort of sounds like it's well-liked, but maybe not an appropriate expenditure, given the St. Peter resource being 9 miles away. But I'm very concerned about that recommendation for lots of reasons. You have to remember that the psychiatric hospital, which is in ISJ in Mankato, 10-bed unit now, one unit, one floor. It doesn't have like at Hennepin, where you have separations of these units for levels of acuity. So it's a very, very problematic situation when you have highly acute ill patients with elderly, with adolescents, and they need to be able to move people off to the St. Peter system and are having difficulty doing that. But the crisis center is in the center of the regional center right now. St. Peter is not the regional center. And transportation costs, this is one of the issues of relating to shifting the costs over to our local police department or sheriffs to have to do all the transporting to move people throughout this system from New Ulm, which also uses the crisis center, and from Mankato. You know, so it doesn't make sense to me to transfer all these positions where you'll have to increase positions in order for them. I have an email just here that I received this morning that clearly states from the people at the Community Behavioral Health Hospital in St. Peter that they will have to increase space, they will have to have additional providers. Their impression is the state is just telling us that they're planning to do this, but the probability of the services being followed through on are very poor given the financial constraints that are on the state. So, you know, when you're telling me that this is going to occur in how much time in the next couple of months, I'm wondering what there is to stop that for another look, a proper analysis of what might better be a better solution for dealing with and not creating a crisis in psychiatric services in our part of the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, what I will say is, like I said, the Crisis Center has been providing a service that has worked well for the people that it's provided services to. This may not be perfect, and I prepared you all that this, you know, any of these changes that are a result of what has to happen fast in order to get to a budgetary savings that we have to get to may not be perfect. However, it has to be done in a way that we can assure that there's some capacity for us to maintain providing that level of care. So there are not 16, the census at the St. Peter Community Behavioral Health Hospital is not 16. There has been consistently bed capacity there. It happens to be a well-utilized facility, so the census on average is higher than some of the others, but it's certainly not 16. There's certainly a capacity, and we want these community behavioral health hospitals to be able to provide multiple levels of care. That's one of the things that will be occurring in this redesign, so that a crisis bed could be utilized there, so you don't have the cost of duplicating staff. So what I can say is we've got people aggressively working on this live right now, trying to figure out how to make certain that that can happen. We're very open to dialogue with the county and with other providers in the area to see other options that they can provide. I know that there was some drop-in component to what the crisis center was providing. That's not going to be able to be provided necessarily by being 9 miles up the road, and I recognize that. But that does mean that we might need some help in coming up with some other ideas about how to provide that component of care that won't be able to be provided. So we can't duplicate everything that the crisis center was able to do, but this was clearly a way of trying to combine services into one facility to achieve a savings. This was, again, something that just had to happen rapidly because we had to get to these figures pretty quickly.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Yeah, I think clearly that the goal here is to solve the state's financial problems. I really can't talk about this then as mental health service transformation. It's not transformation. In this instance, it's a degradation of our health, of our mental health services in our part of the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, what I will say is that if we can't all step back and really be honest about our task at hand here, we're not going to get there. We're not going to get to a different place to be. A different place to be is figuring out these systems and these levels of care so that they can be as efficient as possible, so that we don't have to have these type of dialogues about trying to keep a program in existence because it's not sustainable, because it's not generating the revenue it needs to in order to make it viable. There's ways to do things differently, and that's what we've had to go about. If we can create levels of care so that inpatient care and crisis beds could be provided in the same facility and there's a sharing staff, a sharing resources, that's more efficient and that's less costly to the system and ultimately can lead to more services being available for that outpatient sector that we want to be really investing in.
And I'll just make one final comment about that. I think the resistance is to the fact that the analysis, the root cause analysis of why you can come to the committee and say that that the crisis center cost savings can occur has to do with the fact of the limitations and the restrictions and the boundaries they've placed and the capacity of the community to utilize it appropriately. And if those were reexamined, that you'd see a very different outcome at that crisis center.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, and we may, and that may very well be. I think it gets down to we have another issue at stake here, which is the complexity of how the state-operated services system has been arranged and defined and budgeted and financed, and that that particular facility, even if it was billing for those services, we'd still have to think about it, can we combine services somewhere to achieve some savings somewhere, and where can we do that in a way that we can still serve the same people.
And Senator Berglin, I can't disagree with that. It's just that I think you're about to repeat the same error, which is to make a decision based on economics rather than on logical course of action based on where the population is and where the service providers are. And so I think you're simply not learning from history but repeating history here.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I understand that. And this is one particular response in this plan that is about combining in order to achieve some level of efficiency. And that one's not perfect. It's not a perfect plan, but it gets us to a figure that can add into the $17 million. That's the reality.
So do you want to go on? I forgot. Senator Fischbach hasn't asked a question.
Senator Berglund, Doctor, just going back to a question that Senator Lynch had, and how many of the employees that from Cold Spring that have been transferred, well, you had mentioned that they may be now let go from their transfer job, from the job they have now. Do you know what the number would be on that? And then second, the Cold Spring facility is brand new. I mean, I'm not entirely sure if it's, you know, it's only like a couple of years. I can't remember exactly. What, do you have plans on what to do with that, or is it just going to sit out there, or?
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, first of all, in response to your latter question, we don't own the facility, so it was being leased.
Okay.
So, and there's an X amount of time in which it takes to get out of the lease. I think it's 60 days, and then that owner will find a new occupant for the facility. I don't have the number in response to the first question. I don't have the exact number on how many people will be directly impacted because of all the seniorities people are able to bump and move and take positions at different levels than others. And our human resources division will be working through that aggressively with every individual. So I don't know how many will be impacted.
The net impact is 26 positions on this chart.
The net impact would be that those 26 positions, that the full-time equivalents that were assigned to Cold Spring will no longer be in the system. It's a reduction of those full-time equivalents. But the people impacted, I don't have the answer to, because they may be able to move into other areas.
We actually, Madam Chair, we won't know the answer to the people question until the process is done, because the employees will get to choose about vacancies that are open and whatnot. Right now, all those people are temporarily reassigned. Now that we've made this decision, we'll move forward into the actual reduction, which means they'll be able to bid on positions and actually be assigned a full-time position or a part-time permanent position.
So, Madam Chair, if I can continue on, or?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, to follow up with first with Senator Fischbach's comment, I think your chart on the projected savings and the FTE impact is a little misleading. And I'm concerned, frankly, that you may not, with your plan, get your achieved savings, because we've already heard, for example, Senator Sharon made the comment about Mankato, St. Peter expanding and having to account for presumably that expansion. So I'm a little concerned about your projected savings. I read here that in closing Eveleth that you're saying that you're going to save 18, but I'm not really sure if you're really going to save 18. But if I'll move on, and I would like to just echo Senator Berglund's comments about the dental services, and let's be very clear and not try to skirt around this. There are far too many Minnesotans within SOS as well as outside of SOS that don't today have access to dental services. So to suggest that, you know, somehow by reducing this and sending these individuals over to community clinics or some other new model and miraculously they're going to be served, we're not able to serve those that we have in the system today. And my final comment is that I was really pleased to hear you talk so much about the need to integrate and the need for partnership and the outreach that's been done. It strikes me that if those items were important and if that outreach had been done, I wonder if you would have seen that at the Evla facility. And it wouldn't be a surprise to you that perhaps there are some additional circumstances there that they already have a regional center in place.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, in response to the questions regarding dental, you've heard me say this so repeatedly in the last year and a half that if we truly are going to be assigning the state-operated services as a dental provider, if we are going to be creating a state-operated dental service and it needs to be kept into existence, then all of us need to come to agreement that that is part of the mission of state-operated services, and we have to re-examine how that gets funded because it currently is not funded. And I'm not here, if you've heard me, you've noticed that I've not said, should we or should we not be doing this? What I've said is those individuals are getting access to services through state-operated services because they, for whatever reason, and for a variety of different reasons, have not been able to get access in other areas. Yet, it should not be only up to me to determine, is that part of the state's mission? If it's part of the state's mission and we all collectively agree to that, we've got to come together and figure out how to make that work. Currently, there is no way to make it work. So currently, in the current way that we're providing it, we just simply can't do it in this manner any longer. That's part of the ugliness of what this situation currently is. And I recognize that there will be a lot of questions and a lot of why are we doing this versus that? Why are we cutting the Evolith program? Well, if the Evolith program can still provide, if a different level of care there can serve people there and do it at a different model that actually maximizes revenue increases from other sources, you know, with that explores the whole array of potentials, then that is leading to transformation. That is leading to a different place that ultimately can be more sustainable. What I will say is this is not a reflection of anybody working at Evolith or being served at Evolith. That particular program is not clear in its identity of who we serve and how we serve them and what our classification is. And so this is moving into providing some clarity at that level of care.
So I feel like we need to move on here.
So what I just outlined for you is the ugliness of this entire plan. And as I prepared for you is part of this plan has to get us some immediate savings. And those phase one, step one, are the four things that lead to dramatic changes that will have impacts that are not perfect, but accomplish about half of the savings that need to be accomplished. The other part of phase one, step one, is the creation of these transition design work groups. And ultimately, four work groups need to be designed. One is, or need to be assembled. One is the psychiatric level of care work group. We are inviting people to the table today. Know that we need a lot of help from everybody to really, truly accomplish this in the best way possible. This is an open invitation to participate, but we will need to begin a psychiatric level of care work group next week, and that'll be ongoing. We will need a psychiatric access service work group to be developed. We will need a child and adolescent psychiatric service work group to be developed, and we will need a psychiatric access transportation service to be developed. These are four ongoing work groups made up of consumers, families, advocates, providers, payers, consultants, and our Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration staff.
So, Dr. Sulik, psychiatric access transportation service is something that you are not doing now.
Correct.
So you would be adding a new service, and I'm just wondering what the cost of that would be.
Madam Chair, we don't know yet. because currently...
Well, we better know before we do this plan,
well,
my
we need
friend.
To,
we better know.
Madam Chair, we got a plan to figure out how it could be funded. Currently, there's a lot of money paid for the transportation of individuals.
I know,
a really
but it's
inefficient
not,
system.
But it's not necessarily coming out of the state budget.
It's an enormous cost to the counties. And so this is an opportunity
for
the counties to be there with us.
There are a lot of things happening to funding for the counties through the governor's unallotment, through things the legislature's doing. I mean, you know, this is a time when we have to be very careful about taking on new responsibilities, in my opinion, even responsibilities that might be desirable, because we're having a very difficult time keeping the services we already have.
Madam Chair, I understand. So what I can say to that is we don't hear that is not worked out yet. What we're making is a commitment to bring this work group together to try to really course through what are the options to provide transportation in a different way that, again, may clearly be less costly to the counties than using law enforcement in the manner that they're being forced to be used today. That's what we want to get to. Okay. So the psychiatric level of care work group, actually we have a consultant in from the state of Massachusetts who can work with us starting next week. Uh-huh. So invitations have been out since the end of last week and this week, trying to get people to an initial meeting, but these, again, will be ongoing meetings, to really explore level one, level two, and these PERTS levels of care being proposed here and how they could work regionally across the state. The next work group is to develop a psychiatric access service work group. Again, same thing to develop. Part of this work group is to create a very rapid transition from our current central pre-admission process to be aligned with this new access service. Know that we heard loud and clear that we've got to change the structure and the process of our central pre-admissions process, and this is the commitment to making certain that that happens. In the proposal, I'll talk about this in step two. There is a proposal to try to expand child and adolescent behavioral services by developing a PERTS level of care, perhaps in the northern part of the state, and transitioning the Wilmer facility to that PERTS level of care. But in order to accomplish that, it really does require developing a contract bed concept for child and adolescent services, modeling after what we've done with adult services in the state. That's not worked out, but we will have a work group of all key stakeholders starting to explore how to maybe make that work. If we can make that work, we can utilize the child and adolescent psychiatric specialty centers in the state for the high-level intensive inpatient care, perhaps developing a contract with them for those beds, but then expand the psychiatric extensive recovery treatment service level of care into the Bemidji area and other perhaps other areas in the state where there's currently no services available for kids. And I talked about the access transportation service work group already. So we will be holding also community information meetings on the state and private partnership models beginning in June. We'll be working with some consultants about what those models could actually look like and how to develop a contract. Essentially, the state intends and wants to continue to be in the role of providing direct care services. So as we move into partnerships, one of the concepts here is it possible to have community partners take over the business licensing for the service and contract with the state to provide the direct care services, and to do so in a way that those services are we're essentially sharing in our resources and sharing in the appropriation with the community partners. That's a way to incentivize the partners to be at the table with us to get there. The goal here is that literally every level of service that the state is providing would ultimately be partnered, and by partnering with other business partners across the state, every service would ultimately be able to maximize the whole array of funding resources available. Now, phase one, step two, moves us towards this transformation design. There will temporarily be two community behavioral hospitals converted or transitioned to this PERTS level of care while we are developing this regional private state
private partnership concept. Essentially, we want to develop some model of whether it's an RFP process or some other process where there's an invitation out to work with regional partners to explore, should the Wilmer facility develop into a level one level of care? Should it develop into a level two level of care? Should it remain a PERTS level of care? That's yet to be determined. And the only way we can determine that is really be at the table with those regional partners, aggressively doing the analysis and exploring what level of care would be most appropriate, and then how to move into partnerships to allow that care to be developed there. So that would be focused on Wilmer and Wadena would both transition within the next several months into this PERTS level of care. That PERTS level of care is a lower level of care, so there are some savings attached to transition. So there are some employees impacted by moving to that lower level of transitional care. We would establish a state-operated service psychiatric nursing facility by transitioning the state-operated service nursing facility currently under the forensic service and moving it essentially out of the organization of the forensic services so that it can serve the entire system and not just forensics. You know, we have a new state-operated services nursing facility with 48 beds on the St. Peter campus. There's truly capacity to better serve individuals if that was not restricted solely to forensics patients. By doing that, we can move one unit at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center to that facility. There's at least one unit at Anoka that the patients on that unit are individuals with complex medical problems that really do require skilled nursing facility level of care. The idea here is that those individuals could be served in that the skilled nursing facility. There would be, in step two, we hope to have at some point in the next 15 months the formality of a 24-hour psychiatric access service implemented. We intend to enter into these partnership discussions, as I mentioned earlier, around the Wilmer and Wadena PERTS, and eventually to convert the CABS and Wilmer to a PERTS and establish another PERTS level of care in northern Minnesota for child and adolescent behavioral services if we're able to get these contract models to work effectively. The next under step two is to operate the is to convert the Minnesota Neuro Rehabilitative Service in Brainerd to a 16-bed neurocognitive PERT with transitional intensive treatment foster homes developed in the area to serve those individuals. MNS has been classified as a psychiatric rehabilitative hospital. CMS made it clear that it was no longer meeting the classification criteria for a psychiatric rehabilitative hospital. We are exploring essentially the development of a neurocognitive PERT serving individuals with traumatic and acquired brain injuries. That model of care in combination with being able to transition to intensive treatment foster homes can still serve the same number of individuals, actually serve them perhaps as we propose much more efficiently. But we also want, through the creation of level one psychiatric care facilities, that those level one care facilities develop the expertise to manage the individuals with traumatic brain injuries, manage individuals with developmental disabilities who have highly complex needs, who ultimately may have been served at the expectation would be that they'd be served at MNS or MEDO at that higher level of acuity. You heard me talk about MEDO in the past, that my assessment of MEDO is that MEDO has been forced to manage individuals with much higher level of acuity than they were really set up to be able to manage. Our expectation is that an individual with developmental disabilities, with complex psychiatric illnesses, the complex behavioral disturbances, could be acutely treated at a level one psychiatric care facility until they are actually able to be transitioned into a neurocognitive PERT level of care. Again, PERT meaning psychiatric extensive recovery treatment services. Again, there would be transitional intensive treatment foster homes developed for the MEDO facility, that neurocognitive PERT in the Cambridge area as well. So people would, just like modeling after what's been done at the Pillager home, that has been a successful model for serving the MITO population, and we essentially want to move into that model and have more of those available to us. I am well aware that there are no layoff provisions in language for the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and the MITO. We are hoping that we can solve through that, because this plan does entail there would be full-time equivalent positions reduced at Anoka with the closing of one unit and moving that unit to St. Peter. Not every employee at the Anoka would clearly want to move to St. Peter, and so there would be people impacted. And then there would also be jobs impacted from the MITO campus, which I will walk through on another slide here. If you look at this slide, phase one, step two, this outlines the projected savings from transitioning Wadena to a PERT, a savings of about $0.9 million in the biennium, reducing the total number of full-time equivalents at that facility by 14. By transitioning Wilmer to a PERT would lead to a savings of approximately $1 million, transitioning the and impacting potentially a reduction of 19 full-time equivalents. Closing the Anoka unit and moving that unit to a psychiatric nursing facility would lead to essentially $200,000 in savings, because there would have to be staffing up at the St. Peter nursing facility, and that would lead to 17 projected full-time equivalents impacted from the Anoka Regional Treatment Center. Converting MNS to a neurocognitive PERT actually has a cost attached to it, because currently MNS was under our enterprise system, so actually has no funding attached from the appropriation. By the fact that CMS has changed its definition and classification requirements for a psychiatric neurorehabilitative hospital, there is no source of income for MNS. Minnesota Neurorehabilitative Services. That's the program in Brainerd. Currently housed on the Brainerd campus in one of the remaining facilities that we're still using there, one of the remaining buildings we're still using. But there are, there's actually a, there are full-time equivalents impacted.
Can you just explain why it costs money to do that conversion?
Because there's currently no funding in the appropriation for that program. So that program, because it no longer has, because it was in the enterprise component of, the, of our structure, it was not under, there's no state appropriated dollars for that program. It no longer has the ability to bill because it no longer is a psychiatric neurorehabilitative hospital. And therefore, by moving into this neurocognitive PERT, and now keep in mind that we will be going through changes that we're analyzing what changes might need to occur in our state plan to determine getting appropriate federal reimbursement and other areas of reimbursement for these various services. This is a proposal to keep the program for traumatic and acquired brain injuries in existence, but structured in a model that's very similar to what we're doing across the entire system. This PERT
Dr.
level
Sulek,
of care is appropriate.
Wouldn't the PERT earn federal reimbursement?
It will, yes.
So why couldn't that facility stay operating as it does today as an enterprise service?
Mike, you have some thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, the funding, other states are providing a PERT level of care that is federally reimbursed. It doesn't exist right now in the state plan. So when Dr. Sulek alludes, we need to do some work with the state plan. Eventually, we believe it will be fully funded, similar to what ERTs are, for example. But we don't have that today, and we have to make this change before we would be able to get the state plan amended.
State plan can be amended quarterly.
Yes.
So are we waiting for something?
Madam Chair, it can be amended quarterly. It's just that whether it gets responded to that rapidly and really gets into existence, we're trying to be as conservative as we can in these estimates, and that's why that's outlined in this manner. Let me talk about the MITO facility, because this is the big one being impacted here. You know, MITA was last November, 2 Novembers ago, when I first came in and gave you all an update on MITA. You recall at that time, MITA was a 48-bed facility. There were 4 beds decertified and became a 44-bed facility. It was staffed for 44 beds. The average census at MITA has been between 21 and 25, probably an average daily census of about 23 in the last 15 to 18 months. You heard me talk about the various levels of care coming through MITA, that the expectation when MITA, when I went back and looked at the history of MITA, when MITA was first designed and created, it was not designed to be a facility where somebody would stay for a year or 2 years or 3 years. Average cost per treatment episode today at MITA is over $1 million per person. So
look, I believe when you first came to your job, we had a hearing about this, and we tried to have a discussion about this with you, feeling that there could be a downsizing of MITA at that time.
Well, Madam Chair, this is what we've come up with. By aggressively looking at this, we can come up with, this is a model that we can stand behind that makes a lot of sense given the array of needs that we have in the state. What's proposed here is to develop a neurocognitive PERT serving individuals with developmental disabilities and complex psychiatric illnesses. They would have access to ongoing psychiatric care and monitoring as proposed, but there would also be an array of transitional foster homes being that these individuals could transition out of the PERT into that level of care as we've started to do at the Pillager home. This will shorten the length of time required in the PERT dramatically. And essentially completely transform and redesign the services that are currently provided on the MITA campus so that it's not seen as a program for such long extended stays. There's another piece on this slide that I just want to bring reference to, and that is that every employee in state-operated services was asked to engage in an exercise with their manager to examine all the costs in the entire system, to look at their actual budget, and to come up with and propose areas in which savings could be achieved. This has been a huge, huge undertaking. You will hear gripings from some employees that didn't like being requested to do that. However, what I will say is almost all employees provided some information and really participated. There's been over 300 proposals that have been submitted to the State Operated Services Central Office to be examining. Those are being still reviewed. The array could be anywhere from $3.8 million or more of savings that are being identified. This was an incredibly creative undertaking by the employees of state-operated services trying to examine themselves to see where are things that we could do differently. This means even just changing the way that they cover a shift a little differently in a lot of different areas. I don't have the details of this because it's still being reviewed live. The deadline to get these into us was just within the last 2 weeks, so they are being analyzed and summarized right now. But there is already a projected savings of approximately $3.8 million that could be used here to go towards a $17 million deficit. Keep in mind that this keeps services in existence. This is our state employees coming to the table and really trying to work with us to figure this out with us.
Dr. Sulik, we're going to have to wrap up your presentation. We may have to have you come back.
Great.
But I do have a last question for you, and that is, as I review your materials that you're presenting to us today, the only change I see in the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center is moving some patients to St. Peter. Is that correct? Is that the only reform we're seeing out of the reform that was actually given to you to do by the legislature?
Madam Chair, that's the phase one, step two portion of the reform. When I have more time, we will talk at length about phase two and phase three proposed. Essentially, what you can think about is that we are proposing and will propose that there is a model to have partnered units with regions, with Fairview University, with Hennepin County Medical Center, and working with our consultants from the other states to help us develop these contracts and partnerships so that there could be units shared with those facilities and perhaps other facilities
as a different model to the ANOCA structure. That is what's being proposed. The details of this are not in here at this point because it's not the immediate part of phase one that's being presented here today.
Dr. Sulik, I must just say that I'm disappointed in that part of your proposal, and that what you're talking about is far different than what we talked about when we did the bill.
Madam Chair, what I'll say is, in order for you to understand, for any of us here to understand what is and will be proposed about a redesign of ANOCA, is you have got to understand this entire proposal. You've got to understand the creation of a level one psychiatric care facility, a level two level of care, a PERTS level of care, a transitional foster level of care. You know, you've got to understand that and grasp that, recognize how it can work elsewhere in our state to be able to understand the proposal that will come forward from our regional partners and us about modeling that same level of care that we're proposing across the state in the metro region. Those concepts are critical.
Dr. Sulik, I think I listened and I think I understand. You still have an empty facility in Bloomington, is that correct?
Madam Chair, we looked at that facility, and what I've been counseled on is it because of pipes and elsewhere, that facility still would take about a year before it could be operational.
Well, because it's been sitting empty for so damn long. It isn't that we haven't brought this up with the department long before you came, Dr. Sulik, that yes. This building was sitting there empty. And I might just add, while I'm at it, that I don't see any PERT that's going to serve the metro area in your design.
Madam Chair, that's part of the ANOCA redesign in the metro region. And so next week,
I just will repeat before I send you away, we asked you to redesign the services at ANOCA. All the rest of this stuff you're proposing to do, we didn't ask you to do that. You volunteered for that. But what we asked you to do doesn't seem to be happening fast enough or with enough vision as far as I'm concerned. I actually thought redesign of ANOCA would begin by this January. So,
right. Well, Madam Chair, as a closing comment, what I will say is I believe honestly that this work absolutely had to occur in this manner. And the only way that we can reasonably get to something that truly can work differently in the metro region is we've got to understand our history and what we've learned from the community behavioral health hospital model. If you go back to what the expectation was when the call to redesign ANOCA was, it's you've done this in the rest of the state. Learn how to why can't you just do that in the metro region? Well, there's a lot of things that we had to learn from that experience that we have learned in the last year in this analysis. I guarantee you that the only way to go forward in redesigning ANOCA into something that's truly efficient, that truly will serve the people in the best way possible that it's charged to serve, is through this model of community partners, and it's through developing structured levels of care that really truly work. So this work, albeit it's big and it's a lot of work, and it may not give you the exact answer that any of us would hope for today, it absolutely had to be done this way. There's no other way to have done this and get this effective in this
manner. Dr. Sulik, this is a very important topic, and this is a very major change that you're proposing, so we'll probably be asking you to come back and answer some more questions about it. But we're out of time for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, just a process question. Dr. Sulik's indicated that phase one is 3 months in length, and I'm wondering when that 3 months starts. And he talks about this in terms of a proposal. Is this something that we can expect to see in the form of a bill? Does this need legislative approval? I'm a little unclear on the jurisdiction here.
I'm sorry we didn't get time to ask those questions. I think those are important questions. In the discussions that Dr. Sulik has had with me, he indicates that he does not believe that there is a need for legislative action. Now, I would remind the members of this committee that the unallotment that the governor did to state-operated services is one time. So, you know, this whole thing that is being proposed seems to me pretty permanent. So I have some of those same questions myself.
Madam Chair, can I just say something on that subject?
I would just also say that sometimes, and I may be I'm wrong, but I get the impression that some of the agencies don't realize that they are answerable to this committee and the committees in the legislature. We have oversight authority on these departments, and they're not only working for the administration, but they're working for us. And you know, if we have to pass a law that says you're going to do it this way, that's the way it'll be done.
Well, Senator Coring, that was my point.
Right.
Earlier.
I was just trying to make it crystal clear for him.
Senator Higgins, I wonder if you mind if we take Senator Kubley's bill first, because he's got out-of-town witnesses, and I know that there's a little bit of controversy about your bill, so I just want to make sure we get the out-of-town witnesses taken first.
Concession was 9/10 of the law.
Welcome, Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, Senate File 31-9 is a bill that deals with some federal dollars for nursing homes that are owned by local units of government. It does have an A1 amendment that Mr. Deal has prepared for us, Madam Chair, and if someone would agree to move that amendment, we could take care of that first, if you like.
Madam Chair.
Just a second here.
The amendment, Madam Chair, would just delay the effective date of the bill that would concur with the state's ability to receive RRA dollars for some of their reimbursements for Medicaid. So
there are provisions in that law that indicate that we cannot increase the responsibility of the counties. So this amendment, it would be
I think
order.
I think the amendment takes care of that, Madam Chair. And
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Madam Chair, I'm ready to help my friend out, Senator Kubley. The only thing is it looks like we have a delete all amendment and then the A1 amendment,
no,
right?
No,
no.
That's for a different bill. So that's why
Higgins.
I was trying to give people time to find Senate File 3019.
I will move the A1 amendment.
Any discussion of the amendment? Sure. Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Right, Senator Kubley, you want to?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. With me today is Kathy Johnson from Johnson Memorial Hospital in Dawson, Minnesota. You know, she's not related to the founder of the hospital. She just happens to be the administrator at the moment. But she can cover the reason for the bill, Madam Chair and members.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity. You know, Dawson, Minnesota is over on the western border. We're about 20 miles from South Dakota. And so some people say Wilmer's the edge of the earth. We say, no, it's not. It's Dawson. And I'd like to just share a little bit of information about us with you. All of Lacaparra County is a population of about 7,000. Excuse me. And we probably serve about 3,000 in our hospital district. And that sounds like a very small number, but it doesn't cover a very small piece of land. We are very rural, and I have always been concerned when I am reading bills and whatnot about the representation of places that are our size. We consist of a critical access hospital, a 56-bed care center. We also have physicians that are our employees, so we have their clinic and home care and an ambulance service. And we have, like I say, about 3,000 people that we represent. And older adult services are of great concern to us because in Minnesota, there's about 12.5% of the population that is over age 65. In 2008, the estimate for Lacaparra County was 22.6% of our population is over 65. And in the city of Dawson, it's estimated that it's about 30% that is over the age 65. Okay. And in our 56-bed care center, we're very proud of it. We have 98% occupancy in the years 2008, 2009, and so far in 2010. And as a matter of fact, last month, well, actually in January, we had 99% occupancy, which means we had one day that was unpaid. So when somebody passed away or went home, we really were busy in getting that turned over to a new resident. Because we are a critical access hospital, we try to serve some of our Medicare folks in their acute stages on that side. But we have budgeted to lose about $600,000 on our care center this year. And last year, we lost about $400,000. And we were cut, as you all know, last year in our reimbursement for about 2.5%. And we're certainly legislated to be cut a little bit further this year. And we are making that up. We are carrying the nursing home right now with our critical access from the hospital side. And I see this bill as being something that can certainly help us close that gap. And this would be at no additional cost to the state of Minnesota. So we're hoping that we can move this forward.
I just have one correction. There were no budget cuts made to nursing homes last year. And there was no allotment by the governor.
I stand corrected because I thought that we did get a cut.
No, group
last
homes,
year.
Home care, every other
yep,
part
home
of the
care
long-term
did too.
Care services got cut, but nursing homes did not.
Okay, well, we still had a $400,000 loss, and like
right,
I say,
I'm not saying you didn't.
Yes,
you know, I don't think it came from this side of the table.
No.
Are there any other questions?
I did inquire how many possible facilities that this could help, and it's about 44 that could be assisted in their reimbursement with this bill.
Right. So I have a question for someone from the department, if there's anyone here. Welcome. Would you like to identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair, my name is Greg Tabell from the Department of Human Services.
Mr. Tabell, I noticed that on the fiscal note there is no cost for any administration or systems changes, and you know, it's kind of hard to know. Sometimes we get them. It's kind of hard to know when we get them, why we get them, and so I was just wondering if there were not going to be any systems costs or administrative costs to administering another tier of rates?
Madam Chair, we don't anticipate any extra costs. The program, if you want to call it that, that would handle these payments. We already have a unit at DHS that does the surcharge, and this would be something similar to the surcharge. The programming to increase the rates of the facility, there's nothing significant there. It's, you know, a programmer would make a few changes to the coding of a program to allow these facilities to have their full rebasing rate if they choose to enter this program.
Are there any other questions? I guess not. Any other questions for Senator Quigley? Okay, then Senator Prettner-Solon will move that Senate File 3019 as amended be recommended to pass. This would not need to be in the budget bill because it doesn't have any general fund impact. It's more of a special revenue type of funding mechanism. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Cooley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Now, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I have Senate File 1137, and there is an A2 amendment. I don't know
if it's been passed out. Right, this is the Delete Everything amendment. So Senator Erickson-Ropes would move adoption of the amendment for Senator Higgins. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank
Senator
you,
Higgins.
Madam Chair and members. This bill is before you because of the potential cost to the original bill. The A2 amendment addresses the costs of the bill.
Well, we're not
a little
sure
while
that
after
it really
you
does, but
pardon me?
We're not really sure that it does, but you may continue.
The fiscal note arrived after your committee started this morning. I have a copy of it, and there are a whole bunch of zeros on it, and I'd be happy to pass it up to you if you would like.
Does it include the amendment?
This is the amendment. Fiscal note. The original fiscal note has been withdrawn. It is no longer available online, and this is the new fiscal note, effective 9 o'clock this morning or so. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Goodnow, who is the president of the Epilepsy Foundation, to explain the negotiations and what all is involved in this bill now.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Higgins. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I'm the board president of the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation. I'm also a father of a daughter with epilepsy. And just for the record, I'm also a registered lobbyist for the Epilepsy Foundation, but I do it on a pro bono basis. The amendment that was adopted was meant for a couple reasons. We worked with the opponents to try to reach an agreement and compromise that folks could sign off on. We were successful in some regards and not successful in others. From the communications I've received from the Department of Human Services and the Board of Pharmacy, we've addressed the fiscal note issue, we've also addressed the issue. Well, I was told that I could also say that the Minnesota Pharmacists Association now supports the amendment. So we think we have a good compromise. What the amendment does is, as we talked, and for those of you that were in policy committee, we talked about the whole issue of substitution of anti-seizure medicines for people with epilepsy and the dangers that at least the neurologists that we had testifying and the American Academy of Neurology and also a number of epileptologists and neurologists from the Mayo Clinic pointed out was there's concern about the substitution of medications for people that have epilepsy. Our original bill mandated that the no substitution take place without the permission of the patient and notification of the doctor. What this amendment does is changes that to say that if the FDA determines that there's a danger to the health of people with epilepsy and taking these medications due to substitution, that the Board of Pharmacy is directed to implement rules that would address that danger. So it's pretty wide open. There is a study that was Congress asked the FDA to look at this issue in November. We're hoping that something will come through. We don't know exactly when that will come through. It's a compromise on both sides because we think there's an issue here, but we're willing to wait and see what the FDA says. I think it's compromised from the other folks saying, well, they don't think there's an issue here, but we're willing to see what the FDA says. And if they come down and say there's health risk, it's appropriate for the Board of Pharmacy to move forward with it. I worked with the Board of Pharmacy on the language, so they've said that it meets their needs and it's something they can work with. And we'd appreciate your support, and I stand for any questions that you may have.
Right. So I think the concern is that not knowing what rules the Board of Pharmacy might promulgate sometime in the future, if the opportunity becomes available, which we're not sure if it will, we're not sure if it would have an impact on the cost of public health programs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Board of Pharmacy has the rulemaking process ability right now, and in talking to Mr. Weiberg, he thought they would have the authority to move forward with the rulemaking process if they saw that there was a need to address a safety issue out there just with regulation of pharmacy in the state of Minnesota. So my understanding is that this is a direction to them that they shall implement the rules. But my understanding, at least from what they suggested to me, was that they already have that authority.
Well, Mr. Goodenow, I think that currently whatever their rulemaking authority isn't being used in a way that might increase cost to our public programs. If it did, I'd be very concerned about that, especially in the environment we're in right now. So that's what the concern is. And while the fiscal note from DHS says zero, it says zero because they believe that the United States Food and Drug Administration will not find that the substitution would pose a risk to patients. And it's unknown if the FDA will make such a determination in the future, but it says the impact to DHS will depend on content of the promulgated rules.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. One of the things that I know in developing fiscal notes at the agency level, they look at how the speculation, and if there's enough speculation in it, if there's enough certainty behind the potential fiscal impact, if there's certainty behind it, they'll put a fiscal note on it. If there's speculation or they don't think it's likely to happen, they won't put a fiscal note on it. All we have to go through in working with the agencies and the board and trying to come up with an amendment that would deal with the fiscal note issue is what they said and what they would put in the fiscal note. And, you know, this may never have a fiscal impact, and you know, maybe it will. But even if they adopted rules, it's the regular rulemaking process that would require an open process and allowing for an open hearing if 25 people wanted a hearing. So
are there any other questions for Mr. Goodenow or Senator Higgins? We do have some people that want to testify in opposition, and there are no other questions, then.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, maybe Mr. Goodenow. Without this legislation, does the board, if the FDA administers a new finding, without this legislation, does the board have the authority to take into consideration that recent ruling and promulgate rules from there?
Madam Chair, excuse me, Senator Lynch, my understanding of the way it was explained to me is that they feel that they currently would have that authority. What this would do would be direct them to actually move forward with that authority and adopt those rules. Additionally, there is a provision in there that says that if in providing for these rules that protect the public and people with epilepsy, that if it conflicts with one provision of the dispenses written legislation, that's a statute that's already there, that the rule will actually supersede the legislation in that regard.
Okay, any other questions? Not, let's see if we can get David, Derrick's, Andy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Girard Associates. I'm representing Mylan today. They're one of the they are a leading generic drug manufacturer. I'm here today to express our opposition to Senate File 1137 as amended. Let me say that if, as a result of the FDA and NIH study or any other reason, the FDA determines there's a need to change the standards for interchangeability of anti-epileptics, we would expect that Minnesota will alter their rules with legislative action. We are concerned this language is sufficiently vague that it permits the Board of Pharmacy to undertake rulemaking even if the FDA has not changed the standards for interchangeability. I'd like to direct you to line 3.6 of the delete all on, 3.6 of the delete all the word may. It doesn't suggest that the FDA has to change the standards for interchangeability. So we are also concerned about the implications of giving the Board of Pharmacy the direction to undertake rulemaking, which would interfere with the existing generic substitution statute. Even though there's no cost to this specific amendment with regard to the rulemaking, the potential implications for significant cost to the state exist if the board promulgates rules that change the substitution law. My understanding, and I can certainly be corrected, but my understanding is that currently the generic utilization of epilepsy drugs is upwards of 80%, and the state spends approximately $15 million annually on these drugs. If there were a change in interchangeability standards, it would be very costly for the state. Obviously, that's only one possibility as an outcome from this legislation, but it does seem unusual to us that a board would have the authority to make a change with potential for that much impact on the state budget without it having to come back to the legislature for review. We continue to suggest there are options in current law to address the notification issues, which were really the substance of the original bill. This bill has changed substantially since then. One thing I'd like to put on the table, and we discussed this with Mr. Goodnow yesterday, was the idea of utilizing the developing e-prescribing system. Now would be a good time to look at that and see how we can provide the notification that these patients are looking for, which was part of the original bill. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do your other witnesses have any testimony? We're very short on time. I'd like to take all the testimony before we do questions.
Sure, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I'll be brief. My name is Dave Dietrichs, and I work for Express Scripts. We're a pharmacy benefits manager. We're based out of St. Louis, Missouri, but we have 1,300 employees in Bloomington, and we manage the drug benefit for approximately 70 million Americans. And I would like to echo the comments that Ms. Cook just made and expand upon a couple other areas. First, deals with the new substitution language that on line 3.6. Right now, the way the current law is written, if the FDA does determine, as Mr. Goodnow said, that there is a danger, then they will issue guidelines that local state boards of pharmacy must follow in accordance so that there will be new rules. Like, for example, if there is a drug recall, so that there's uniformity in terms of the recall across the country. What this language says, if the FDA determines that there is a may pose a health risk to patients. So right now, as Mr. Goodnow stated, the U.S. Congress has directed the FDA to look at this. If these rules or if this law here was enacted, technically the Board of Pharmacy could have rulemaking authority before the FDA even makes a determination, which could take anywhere from 1 to 3 years. So this is a great expansion of current law, which the Board of Pharmacy already does have the authority to make these types of rules. Second, I just would also like to point out that the FDA always does issue guidelines. We would like to see uniformity across the states should there be anything, should there be any determinations that would be adverse. And finally, I'd just like to say that as a company doing the drug spend for or managing the drug benefit for 70 million Americans, we do follow FDA guidelines. Patient safety is the number one factor in all of the decisions we make. We have a clinical committee that I'll let Mr. Beam talk about in a moment here, so that you know that we don't make these decisions based on saving money, but we base these decisions on patient safety. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Andy Baim. I am the Senior Director at Express Scripts in charge of our clinical department. I'm also based out of Bloomington, Minnesota. I just wanted to point out the fact that this is truly a clinical controversy at this time. It's an issue that is unresolved with respect to the published literature that's out there, and clearly there's been no definitive studies noting that there is a link between interchange of these medications and any seizure or an outcome-related risk. So at this point in time, this is clearly, as I think was previously submitted in the testimony, something that's being investigated further. As an organization that bases decisions on evidence, we work with outside panels of physician experts, and clearly the physicians that we work with are very comfortable with the current language, the current standards that exist, and we believe at this point in time it is truly in the hands of FDA as the decision-making body to review this evidence. So I would just echo that as somebody who is firmly behind the practice of evidence-based medicine, that we would certainly be aligning ourselves if and when there was negative data that would ever come out. But at this point in time, as was previously stated, we're comfortable with the language that's out there. We feel like This has not been validated, and certainly do not see the need for this type of an amendment.
Are there any questions for any of these witnesses? Senator Lynch, I'd like to move an amendment to the bill, so if you'd take the gavel for me.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I'd like to move an amendment to your bill that would say if the rule proposed by the board creates an increase in state costs to state public health care programs, the board shall report to the legislature the proposed rule and the increased cost associated with the proposal before the board may adopt the rule.
Madam Chair, that's fine.
Senator Higgins.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, that's fine.
Any questions for members? Okay. Senator Berglund moves adoption of her oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, now I feel comfortable having your bill go on its way. We have to protect the state budget here.
Absolutely we do, Madam Chair. And, you know, we've been terribly concerned about the folks who have epilepsy. And since we've all worked together on this, then I thank you for your interest in this issue.
Stars are all aligned.
If somebody would move the bill, I'd really appreciate it.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 1137 is adopted, as amended, be recommended to pass.
On Senator Prettner-Solon's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion's adopted.
Thank you,
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, we're out of time, so unfortunately we're going to have to reschedule Senate File 481. I'm very sorry. Usually we do a little better job estimating our time, but...
All right.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you. I'd just like to make one comment as people are leaving an observation on Dr. Sulik's transformation plan. I won't make any conclusions, just want to share this observation that in reviewing the locations where the job losses are going to occur and there will be buildings closed, and then observing where the jobs will shift to and where buildings are not closed, I'd like to share this information. Negative effects will affect Senator Tomasoni, a Democrat in Eveleth, Senator Sharon, a Democrat in Mankato, Senator Olstein, a Democrat in Cambridge. Senator Fischbach already has her facility closed, so she's really not affected. And the only Republican senator affected with negative effects is Senator Jungbauer. On the positive side of things, we sort of have the reverse picture. Job shifts and positive effects and buildings not closed would be Republican Senator Gimsey and Wilmer, Republican Senator Dill in Annandale, Republican Senator Ingebrigtsen in Alexandria, Republican Senator Coring in Brainerd, and there is one Democrat who gets some positive benefits. That would be Senator Scogin in Wadena.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. With that, meeting is adjourned.